Hello and welcome to the Plasticology Project podcast, conversations about plastic pollution and stories from inspiring people trying to make the planet cleaner. My name is Dr. Paul Harvey and I am the host and author of the Plasticology Project. Thanks for joining me. It is my immense pleasure to introduce Isaias Hernandez to the Plasticology Project for this episode. Isaias is an environmental educator, environmentalist, activist, and founder of Queer Brown Vegan. Isaias is based in the US, is a heavyweight when it comes to environmental and social justice issues. Through the power of education, Isaias has shaped the environmental justice discourse in the US over a number of years. In addition, Isaias has redefined environmental education by developing new ways to deliver science and engage audiences. Isaias learned the power of social media to reach a wider audience and today shares educational content to millions of people. Isaias, it is an enormous pleasure to have you join the Plasticology Project podcast. Welcome.
Tell me a little bit about yourself and what it is that you do.
Yeah, so I'm an environmental educator. I started off being really interested in climate when I was very young. I was always fascinated by Discovery and Nat Geo shows growing up, watching The Conservationists and, exploring. And I went to Berkeley over there in California to study environmental science. And essentially, I realized how much of education on that space and landscape is really inaccessible for people who just grew up in poverty and poor like me. And I realized, like, how are you going to talk about all of this really great science that's been put out there, but don't know how to interact with the person of color? And I realized that majority of the environmental sector, which I was in within the environmental science, really lacked diversity. It really lacked cultural diversity and didn't really understand a lot of the components of, like, how do you talk to people of color rather than seeing them like, oh, well, you're dumb, so like they won't never understand. And so I think I had this very fragmented relationship with academics, just because I realized that, for some truth, it's really good to put the science out there. We need this for to be able to push policy, to educate the young scholars that are out there. But at the same time, it's a double-edged sword of, like, there is this ivory tower sense of, like, elitism that is, like, perpetuated by these academic institutions. And so I ended up graduating and created this, like, educational page on Instagram. And after a year after I graduated from college, and it kind of started off as very distilling the easy, like, what is series of, like, introductory forms of education. And then it later on expanded into me becoming a content creator and a host to be able to talk about environmental issues. And now I work a lot with academic scholars essentially to kind of translate their science projects or their research articles that they've published, and to talk about these, like, interesting topics that are very fascinating. They're very in depth and very hard to understand, but I help kind of communicate that with them. So I've kind of evolved as, like, a climate educator and communicator through my platform. And so the username is kind of sometimes funny because people are like, you're just an influencer, but I'm like, no, like, I have these lived experiences. I went through academia. I decided not to go to master's school after getting in. And I was like, I could go to a master's program, but that still wouldn't be enough in my realm. So, I realized that, the content creator space as a digital space is for me to be able to communicate with community and then bring them to the other side of other resources and experts, right, that are doing the work in case they're interested in learning more about a certain field.
You've mentioned a couple of things there that are really cool, and I'll touch on those a little bit later on. But I think the idea of translating science and complex science, oftentimes very inaccessible to anybody outside of the particular research group that has generated that science in the first place, is so cool, because from where I sit, there is a science literacy shortage among the global population. And it's something that you've sort of touched on there yourself. And so to be able to communicate the science out into the broader world through social media, because we are the social media generation, and somebody described me the other day as being part of the TikTok generation. I'm not so sure about that. But it's just so cool to hear that you're being able to use your skills, your knowledge, and share what you know with the broader community and the world.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And you know, I think that obviously we can all agree, being in the academic field, is that, you know, people shouldn't be spending thousands of dollars to be able to learn this information, right? Especially when there are crises that are affecting the way that we live, the way that we pay our bills for home, the way that we breathe in this world. And so I think climate literacy is really important to me, because I realize that so many young people are disempowered in movements and instead really take that energy as a form of blaming older people without recognizing that older people are also victims of this injustice of system that was created. And so how do we build intergenerational wisdom through climate literacy is something that I've been really discovering over the last few years, is that a lot of my elders is the reason why I became an environmentalist, that really inspired me to look into these subjects, to look into the field, and to be a part of what you would call the Western science models, to understand, like, how are we talking about these issues, and to also help get funding for young scholars that want to take action in their own institution.
Yes, funding is one of those great challenges that anybody from the research or the academic sector is well familiar with. So certainly anybody that can assist researchers in that space is good value. Take me back a little bit to where it all started for you. You sort of touched on it a minute ago, but let's explore more deeply what got you into becoming an environmentalist. What gave you that passion? What drove you to head down this path?
Yeah, absolutely. So I grew up in Los Angeles, California, and my parents had immigrated from Mexico to the United States. And in the 1980s, for them, they grew up in rural farm areas and were eventually displaced due to economic greed and political policies that were being implemented in Mexico. And for them, I think that, you know, they had this dream of achieving the American dream. And my entire life, I think, to the age of 18, like, I grew up in poverty, where I lived in affordable housing. I partaked in local food banks and food shelters to get food. And I grew up at a very young age recycling cans around the neighborhood. And for those who maybe not really understanding what Los Angeles is, Los Angeles is a very multicultural, diverse city. And a lot of the people there are predominantly Black and Brown. And so for me, I realized at a young age that, yes, I'm poor. And yes, these are the reasons why we live this way, because you're poor. I think I started to question this when I was later in middle school, when I learned about earth science and I learned about the term global warming. And so global warming back then was more of the popularized term in the late 2000s. Climate change was seen as more of a radical thing if you said that. And so I think I got my inspiration a lot watching Nat Geo and Discovery Channel, these science conservation shows, talking about the impacts of global warming. And so I started to kind of understand of, like, okay, so the environment's changing, but, like, what does that have to do with me being poor anyways? Like, you know, it's, you know, Los Angeles is a very rainy season during the winter and hot during the summer. I've grown up that way. I started to kind of grow an interest within environments when we would go to local field trips around the Los Angeles region. And I remember clearly there was this moment where we had to go to a beach trip to go to Malibu or Venice, I believe, to pick up trash. And I remember, like, asking the ocean conservationists there of, like, why do we have to pick up trash for these rich communities? And why doesn't no one come to our communities to pick up trash? And I remember the teacher silenced me and told me I was being so disrespectful and rude for asking that question. But I think that for me was more about not being angry at the individual, but just asking, like, why do we have to pick up your trash? Like, don't you all have the economic resources? Because I grew up being told that the reason my environment was dirty was because poor people don't care about their environment. And so I think for me, that started to kind of address the intersections between poverty, climate change, and wealth redistribution models. And it was later until high school I learned about the term environmental justice through a school auditorium presentation. And one of the things that the environmental justice organizer said is that look at look go to Google, look at the environmental justice website from the EPA, and type in your zip code. Your zip code will tell you the amount of contamination that you are based on your income, the race, and the ethnicity of the communities. And I Googled it later on after the presentation, and it had high level rates of air pollution, water pollution, which I had already known growing up because I lived nearby a factory. Like, I know that it was already polluted. But to see the fact that this is something that is real, where if you go a few cities away in the wealthier areas in Los Angeles, they don't have this. And so that kind of started to get me to ask, like, why is it that like poor people have to live this way? Like, is it really because we didn't work hard in life, or is it because of existing policies and practices that prevented many like people like me and people who look like my family to be able to live in a healthy environment? And so the concept of environmental justice for me at a very young age just meant everyone should have access to clean air, water, and soil. It doesn't matter your race, your gender, your class, like everyone should have it. That should be an environmental right for everyone. And I think that's really those main points as a young person that got me really invested in learning about the environment. But I'd say that there wasn't really one specific big moment. It was more of these fragmented memories I had because there was a lot of disconnection. There was a lot of the courses I took in education were very poor, and there was this lack of intersectionality being talked about of how this is interconnected. And so I think that reconfirmed my step to wanting to study the environmental science, because I realized environmental science is a broad major in which you touch at both the social, biological, and the physical sciences. And so for me, as someone who just did not really know what I wanted to do, I said, well, this seems like a very circular major that will help me understand the social side, the biological, and the very heavy science side. So let's do it. And so I would say that really influenced me to being an environmentalist and really being committed to studying environmental science throughout my time in school.
Yeah, that's a really cool journey and inspiring, I think, for anybody that is trying to decide what they want to do, whether they're in school at the moment or perhaps they've left school and they're trying to figure out which way to go. I think your journey will speak to a lot of people. You spoke to environmental justice a moment ago. The term environmental racism also gets used. Have you heard that term before, and are you familiar with how it might apply in this situation?
Yeah, no, absolutely. So environmental racism can be best defined as the existing policies and practices that disproportionately affect majority of people of color in communities that are typically low income and in rural slash urban areas. And so with environmental racism, I think that a lot of people sometimes don't understand is that we're not saying that nature is racist. It is true when people say, well, the environment can't be racist. I'm like, correct. Mother Nature is not racist, but the people in power that designate the policies and practices that determine whether you live in a healthy environment or not can, in fact, be racist and very influenced by political corporate money. So, in terms of environmental justice and environmental racism, it wasn't until college when I finally realized like my neighborhood is an environmental justice community. So I give this really good example about Los Angeles. Los Angeles was a huge victim to redlining, and environmental racism can manifest in different forms within policy. So redlining is a very perfect example I love to tell people, is that redlining was disproportionately ensuring that there was segregation towards Black and white communities. And so with redlining, a great example of this is that during World War II, as it was ending, many veterans were coming back. And so as many veterans were coming back from the war, They promised them to that the banks promised them and the government promised them that they would be able to buy a home by taking out a loan for serving in America. What happened was that many white people were very upset with the fact that the government was allowing Black and brown and other people of color to live in their neighborhoods. So what they did is that they mobilized, they worked closely with the city governments and the local banks to say, please do not give these people money. The only way to give them money is if they live somewhere away from these neighborhoods where there's other people of color. And so what you see today in Los Angeles as the urban area and how gentrification is playing a huge role is how Black and white communities were separated. And so for in my community specifically, you know, you get this example of like what came first, the chicken or the egg, right? And in this case, it's kind of like what came first, the industry or the poor people? And, you know, I try to distill this information that these factories, although being built in the during the industrial era in Los Angeles, they essentially were supposed to be shut down years ago by the EPA. And the fact that they were formerly Superfund sites, which are highly contaminated areas. And so what happened is that there's a lot of NIMBYism in Los Angeles where a lot of rich affluent communities are like, we don't want public transport. We don't want anything that makes large noise. And so a lot of low-income communities where I live right next to the train tracks where the Metrolink passes. And then I live right next beyond that near a toxic, former toxic facility that just, I think Believe finally shut down because the property was sold for real estate development, which is another conversation to have, showcases the fact that, you know, we weren't really ever included by these developments, by these policies that were being implemented. And for many low-income communities, the reason why they don't fight back is that they know, and city governments know this too, is that a lot of people don't have the time or resources to sometimes go after work, after working two jobs and taking care of the family, or even the fear of being deported because they know that many immigrants are undocumented, so they can use that against them in case of surveillance. And so I'd say that environmental racism really influenced and allowed me to validate the fact that the occurrences that I thought were natural or because my parents didn't work hard in life were in fact designed by a racist system that was meant to prevent people of color, specifically Black and Indigenous people, from, you know, succeeding in society. And so this also goes back into the wealth, you know, the wealth gap that currently exists in the United States. So I would say environmental racism and environmental justice go hand in hand in understanding the fact of To get access to clean air, water, and soil, we need to examine the current policies and infrastructure in place that got us to these environments that we're living in today. Because rich communities are able to fight off any toxic facility, or God forbid, a toxic incinerator would be built in their backyard. They would mobilize and get that thing out quickly. But with low-income people, we're at a disadvantage because our communities have already been plundered. Our soil is already contaminated. Our water is already contaminated. Our health is already deteriorated. And so that must mean that we have to put in much more work and effort to fight against these injustices.
Do you think, from what you've seen in your work and your knowledge, that there is a hope that these communities that are impacted by these industrial activities, this enormous pollution problem, do you think that there's an actual future where the communities can live happily, healthily, and in harmony with the environment? Or is it too far gone already?
Yeah, you know, I think this kind of goes into these climate emotions of climate doom or, you know, climate anxiety. I think one of the things that has kept me really grounded as an environmental educator in this space is recognizing the resistance of movements have always existed to create a regenerative just world. And this is where intergenerational wisdom really plays in key, is that, you know, it's true that, you know, older generations came into a place where the planet may have been much more in a healthier state. But it's untrue to say that no one was doing anything, right? Like our elders, indigenous people, rural and poor people were taking stances against these corporations and these neoliberal policies that essentially plunder their communities. Like that has always existed and still exists today. And so what I think that in terms of like, do I still have hope for the future? I think that as long as I'm still alive, that is more than enough for me to fight, right? I think a lot of us always think that we need to have this extravagant technocratic solution developed, but the reality is that our own existence is part of the solution. And so when we have become such isolated beings from our community, we forget to know what is currently happening, what crises are emerging. And so I'd say that in terms of the very concentrated powers in the global north are being interrogated at the moment, I do think that the resistance to liberate ourselves from the ecological crisis will come from grassroots. Because I think that at the same time, I do believe that policy is important too, and it should be implemented, it should be advocated because it reduces harm. But we have to also understand within our politics that we have people here in the United States, on me as a US citizen, that have been heavily influenced by these corporations. Since when did deciding the future of our future generations depend on who's sponsoring the most money from a corporate standpoint that has no political degree, these are things where you start to ask yourself, why did we allow companies to privatize water in the global south? These are things where you start to recognize, so as plastic continues to increase, right, globally, and we have all these plastic products, it's being shipped out to rural communities. And at the same time, these people are the ones that are still finding solutions amongst those crises. Even if they don't want to use those materials, they're like, you know, there's another way to repurpose this. There's another way to create a local economy from this. Is it sustainable? I don't know. But is it worthwhile to allow for the survival and the existence of my community? Yes, because we already exist in this problem. We can't just opt out of like, well, I choose to opt out of not really thinking about this issue, right? It's interconnected. So I think that the hope isn't so much of me saying, oh, well, younger generations will fix this. It's more about, I believe that we can create this regenerative just future, but I don't think that it's going to be romantic either. It's going to be very realistic of feelings hurt, of the decentralization of power, and of reckoning of the colonial history that has been happening to these communities that have been the most harmed from this. So as long as we have those leaders from the most affected communities at the front lines to be able to be in those policy rooms, to be able to implement it and to be able to redistribute that wealth to their communities, that can be done. But I do think that when we look at the fact of, well, who created this crisis, it's honestly a very few select powerful transnational corporations and fossil fuel industries and petrochemical industries that committed to doing this. So I think collectively, us versus them, we can get those individuals to maybe recognize the harm that they've committed, but we have to redesign an economic system that actually values ecological well-being for all species.
Recently, the United Nations passed a resolution that was strategically designed to enshrine the environment and a safe, clean, healthy environment as a human right. What are your thoughts on that?
I think in terms of the funding and like redistribution, I think it is essential, right? Because we realize that you can't really design something without capital, right? There's no such thing in this economic system where you can just opt out and not think about that. I do think that the United Nations, for what it's worth as an institution, I think they've realized that, you know, you both need individual and systemic change, but you also need to have those conversations with those corporations. Would I personally want to have them? No. But the United Nations, are they willing to have it? Yes. And I think those are the experts that are those in those industries that can maybe assess their, them honoring their goals and their commitments, but also recognizing that if they're going to be committing to climate action and climate goals, they also need to be redistributing power, decentralizing themselves from these large systems. Because I realized that, you know, a company can create as much as sustainability programs on the side or fund all these sustainability programs, but still not do anything to change their supply chains or their business policies. And so what difference does that make in terms of their footprint, in terms of their operations? I know they're helping these small orgs, and I know that, you know, those orgs are doing really good work. And unfortunately, I'm not going to attack them because that's the way that they get funding. But at the same time, you can't just keep funding programs outside and thinking, you know, this is going to be okay, because it's not really going to be okay in the long term. And so I think the United Nations really does represent multilateralism in a very efficient way of recognizing, how do we get these governments from different countries to have this facilitated discussion? But at the same time, I do think that it is worth noting that, you know, we've been having these types of institutions exist as proxy for decades. Like, the goal is that the United Nations shouldn't be existing in the future, but it still is needed because of all the human rights that have been committed and the atrocities that have been committed in different countries, that they still need to be there to have those conversations.
Let's change pace a little bit now and hear a bit more about the work that you're doing on the day-to-day basis. Tell me what it is that you're up to, and run me through a day in the life of yourself.
I created Queer Brown Vegan back in 2019 as an environmental media platform to essentially advance the discourse around climate crisis and to improve climate literacy. And so a lot of the way that I communicate climate change online is through these digital graphics, illustrations, and video series. And a lot of younger generations, especially Gen Z and millennials, they receive their climate information through three primary sources. It's TVs and films, traditional media, which is like journalism, and new media, which is social media. And so essentially what that means is that a lot of younger people are invested in learning about climate issues and may not have the scientific background to understand. And so Queer Brown Vegan was essentially a stepping stone for people to do that. What essentially I do on my infographics is to kind of distill these long form conversations that are often talked about, whether that be like the carbon footprint or the term petromasculinity, like how that has to do with, you know, fossil fuels and authoritarianism. These are things where I truly believe that this is an intersectional framework for people to develop how environmental issues are actually related, because I think a lot of people know the polar bear and conservation and climate change. They are well understood of that example, but are they aware about fossil fuels, masculinity, misogyny, sexism? Like, how does that intersect with our climate? And so these are things where I feel that are really important for young people's education to know. And the other half is doing a lot of digital video series, is doing long form educational pieces where professors can use my videos as a lecture form for 10 to 12 minutes that looks into certain issues. And what I realized is that a lot of people are into long form of content and they really like to learn. And so as an educator myself, what I love to do is taking my infographics and expanding it into a 12 to 14 minute video, which is kind of supplementary to being able to kind of expand the dialogue amongst the infographics. And so the typical day of me as an environmental worker is, you know, I do sustainability consulting, I'm a public speaker, but the main work to work business days is taking time with my team to find credible resources, brainstorm ideas of how that's going to look, having to design content, right? Like, as a creative and as a designer, I do everything independently. And so, you know, I'm not a nonprofit where I have a team of people doing this all for me. It's only one person and me. And so Queer Brown Vegan, essentially, you know, we really work to actually now focus on working together with researchers in academic institutions and climate authors that have recently written books to promote their books and do giveaways for the community, because I truly believe that, you know, if we're going to actually improve climate literacy, that we extend those conversations beyond just infographics and videos and giving them books to kind of educate them on the climate crisis. So that's a little bit about what Queer Brown Vegan does on the daily basis.
Yeah, it's, it sounds like a busy time for you. It really interests me here that you've moved into the long form communication, and in particular long form videos, because we are told so often that the modern world is 30 seconds or less. You lose the attention after 30 seconds. That clearly hasn't been your experience, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think that with the 30 seconds, is attention span going down? Yes, that has been proven with TikTok and other platforms. However, there is definitely a need for longer form education. And this is because I think as an environmental educator, I built my platform within a niche space, meaning that a lot of the people who follow me are either people who are interested in the environment or are already environmental scholars. So they're already alarmed of about these issues. And so I think that for a lot of young people, the reason why I create these digital media education is because of the lack of diversity that has existed within traditional environmental media spaces. Is that, you know, one of the greatest people I can maybe source is like Bill Nye was a really great science educator. But then when people ask me, well, do you know any of the Black and Brown science educators that you grew up watching? I'm like, you know, I really don't know. And so I think for myself, like, you know, I want to be able to showcase that diversity to young people, to young Brown Latin folks that grew up in similar environments of like, you can do this work. You don't need to be on a TV show. You don't need to have millions of dollars. You don't need to have all these connections. But if you have the heart to create something, you might as well put it out there. And so I think my work is very influenced in terms of disrupting these dominant environmental narratives and adding my personal touch, because I think when I create these long form videos of content, not only do I try to add humor to hopefully get the person to laugh, I also try to add my own lived experiences, because I truly believe that to get people to understand about climate change, you have to also include the storytelling aspect. And so if I'm able to pull research and data and science and factoids from these types of videos, and I can also include my personal narrative, I think that allows the individual to start making the interconnections between their own experiences and the science that they're studying to be able to kind of create this inclusive form of environmentalism that isn't fragmented and actually rooted in unity.
You've developed a very profound understanding of how to communicate, but also what to communicate. Is this something that came just to you sort of overnight? You woke up one morning, I've got it. Or was it something that evolved over time through your study, through your life? Did you, how did you get to this knowledge of how to share?
Yeah, you know, I would say that, you know, the origins is like my mom. So my mom's an educator. One of the stories I usually share with people is that my mom got her degree in education, and a week later she moved to Mexico, and I mean to the United States, and she was deemed illegal, and so she was unable to actually practice education. So she took in my siblings and I and taught us from an educator standpoint how to read and write in Spanish while also learning English. And so like that was really influential for me, because my mom showcased the fact of like, you don't even need to teach at an institution or a school. You can literally teach it through your community, which was my family. And so I think, you know, that allowed me to kind of have this more educator caring role for people. But in college, I think I was a student that not asked the annoying questions, but just asked very questions that were very open to dialogue, and being able to be like, yeah, I'm wrong for asking that question, or I didn't think about that, but I'm glad I asked it because it's an opportunity for me to learn. I think I'm a very social person a lot too. So I think that I've conversated a lot with different people from different communities and different countries. And that has really allowed me to kind of expand my mind and how I view things. But I also attach my work through a spiritual lens. which sometimes a lot of Western science models reject because it's like spirituality is not science. You shouldn't be putting that. But I think that for me, that's what has really allowed me to get to the hearts of people, is to be able to have a humanizing experience and then to push them to the side to the expert to be like, all right, well, now we're going to a more rigid field, which I know can be hard to understand, but it helps you build a foundation. So I really think it was a mix of being able to do a lot of public speaking at a very young age and confronting that, and also getting in trouble a lot in academia of how I was writing. I actually tell people I had professors straight up told me, you really have horrible writing. I don't know how you made it to school, or telling me, I don't even think you should write a book. And I realized, like, it wasn't the fact that they're the haters, but I think that I was able to kind of take criticism from negative to a positive experience as an opportunity to learn. And so now that, you know, I've written over the last few years on social media, I see my writing has improved just for the fact of, like, it's just writing. Like, you're just writing and practicing your brain every day. And so for me, I see it as a very, as an educational experience for me to also be the learner and to be the student. And that's how I think I've been able to communicate climate change for my community, is that I try to make it accessible and easy, but I also try to make it very heartfelt so people don't lose themselves. But there's also a lot of amazing climate educators and communicators out there in the space that have been taking their different approaches, which I absolutely love too.
Your journey in the academic system is probably not unfamiliar to others that have gone through a similar system. You found strength in that, and it's helped you move forward and helped you develop into the person that you are today.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that, you know, I have so many shared stories with a lot of students who may have not been really as smart or attuned in adopting the Western science models as fast as possible. And I think I was probably one of those people that just took time for me to understand, because I realized I did come from a disadvantaged community, but I also realized I had to do more work to catch up, right? And so I think that there was a lot of great mentors I had, PhD students, master's students, who took me in and were like, you know, you can improve and let me help you. And so I think that I didn't really see it as I saw academia as both a very loving place, but a very violent space in case you didn't know how to navigate it. And so because I had the resources and the mentors and the people there, I think that's what really kept me grounded. And so I think in response of me having to face that, I provide as much knowledge as I can today online. So then people that look like me, or people who don't have these, like, they're not as smart or inclined from these like Ivy League institutions, that they're able to enter these discussions at least confidently, being like, at least I know something from this guy because he taught me something. And I think our work is very influenced by people, by culture, by other people's hearts. And I want people to remember me for that, rather than just being like, you know, he was traumatized in academia and he had this bad experience. It's like, no, I had a really good experience. And I also had a lot of learning lessons, and it prepared me to apply to master's school and actually get in, and then realize, you know, this isn't for me. And then just being like, I'm not going to go to grad school anymore.
It's a great journey that you've been on, and I think it will resonate with quite a lot of people. And you know, it's everybody has a different journey that they are supposed to go on in life, and you get off at the different stops along the way when you realize that that's the one that you're supposed to be at. And so, you know, you've gone through your environmental science degree, and now you're taking that and running with it and doing something absolutely incredible on the global scale. So it's by all means served its purpose. There's no doubt about that.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, I, you know, give honoring to all those people who have come before me, and like, you know, the existing people within academic structures that are also fighting to change it to be more equitable, diverse, and all marginalized identities, all people who come from poor backgrounds, or all people who struggle in those spaces, I give honoring to them, because I realized that it wasn't myself that got me through these issues. It was my community. And so I strive away a lot from isolationism and really root my work in collectivism. So understanding that there are people in my work that I may not fully always agree with, but I also recognize that collectively they have a good heart to try to change that. And so that is something where I had to accept when I was younger of like, how do we have room for nuance and discussion without trying to like shut down on each other? And I think it really helped me be able to become a better facilitator in discussions with people and recognize like, you know, it's, they're not coming after me. They're critiquing like critiquing is normal. It happens in academia. And that's something where it's like, how do you develop a equitable shell of yourself to know that it's not coming for your personality, it's just allowing you for a room for opportunity improvement.
Yeah, absolutely. I think what you just said there, having the opportunity to discuss and critique and have essentially a robust discussion on a topic is really important. And I think that applies to not only the academic sphere, but also the conversations that we have more broadly, and in your instance, with the climate change discussion. And it takes me to something that I've seen more and more and more recently. And it's something that I call headline hysteria. And I know that you're very much focusing on the positive message and making people understand climate change, not necessarily through a doom and gloom lens, but showing that yeah, there's a problem, but there's also something we can do about it. Whereas the headline hysteria seems to counter that way of thinking. Have you got any thoughts around that?
Yeah, you know, I think that with climate change in the media landscape, especially with the traditional media, which is the journalism outlets out there, I think that there is some half truth to it of like, you know, the way I communicate climate change isn't always positivity. It's sometimes realistic of, you know, land defenders were murdered. And that is something that we need to recognize that no one is just holding signs of peace. They're literally dying. And so I think that traditional media, you need to follow the money sometimes. And when I say follow the money, just look, it's out there who sponsors these publication. And so there's this double-edged sword of like, although some of the writers really write great articles, I think that there's also this climate denialism that is being pushed out there and not making the front headlines. And it shows the fact of reflects the fact of how corporate interests are willing to do as much as they can to shift the narrative. And I think when it comes to these climate doom articles, I do think that there is some truth of saying, yes, emissions have increased. Yes, are we headed towards 1.5? Yes, we are. I think that is the truth. I'm not saying that should not be said, but I think what I'm being said is that there's sometimes no follow-up to solutions, right? Where are the solutions in journalism? And so I recently am working with the Solutions Journalism Network to showcase local solutions that are happening on the ground, because I think that a lot of people get so hypnotized from these headlines and then become disconnected with their community. There was actually a study that was shown a few years ago that local journalism has declined over the last few decades. And so to me, I kind of link that to climate change, because if less people are getting information on what's happening in their community, they're more likely not to believe what's happening globally because they're so disconnected from their community. And so for me, I think that the way that I've been able to kind of combat that it's to kind of distill these articles sometimes into saying, you know, these are the facts that I think are true, but these are the things that can be challenged and pushed out there. And so I think that a lot of younger generations are kind of now developing this like critical discourse of like, it's not an either or situation, it's an and situation. Like you can say that, yes, we are headed to 1.5 with the projected emissions from these scientists, and we can still continue fighting to preserve the world. And so I think that there's half truths to it, but I also think it's about recognizing that the traditional media is heavily corporate sponsored. And you know, I don't think that a news media should be controlled by one corporation or one individual, which we see in the UK too. It's like owned by I think billionaires over there. So I think that take it with how you see it, but do not use it as a tool to interrogate people and to shut them down as a Bible, right? Like, no one should ever just get an article, throw it at someone's face and say, there, I showed you the truth. I would say, let's sit down and actually discuss and talk about what's happening.
I think you absolutely nailed it there in that response. So thank you. One of the things that you've been talking about recently is this concept of petro-masculinity. Talk to me about what that is.
Yes, so I look up to Professor Kara Daggett's work. She has written so many articles on energy, politics, environmental justice, and she touches a lot about the idea that petro-masculinity is another hyper masculine mode that supports fossil fuels in the rising movements in the US that are centering fossil fuel narratives. And so what she's basically trying to say with petro-masculinity is that fossil fuels mean more than energy, right? They represent actually symbols of masculinity, autonomy, and self-sufficiency. And she does a really good job in portraying the fact that, you know, the idea of fossil fuels was to really benefit global North governments. And fossil fuels essentially threaten energy politics, because in every discourse around renewables, around clean energy, fossil fuels are included. And so what she's saying is that, you know, the death of fossil fuels needs to come from a purge perspective of pulling it out instead of including fossil fuels. And she says it very illustratively, is that, you know, the oil and gas industry is already worth $86 trillion at whole, right? And that benefits shareholders. But she talks about the fact that during the industrialized era, fossil fuels were used as a way to flex dominance over other global South countries as a form of neocolonialism, but also as a form to establish security. And when we talk about security, she meant like security for the nuclear family, meaning the white man with his nuclear family, and the idea of American sovereignty, right? What is American sovereignty and how it's linked to the American dream? And so she really just points out the fact that, you know, the fossil fuel industry benefited largely white men, especially those in corporate industry. But she also says how fossil fuels have become such a national culture of America. And if you look into countries like Texas, in rural countries, they are huge proponents of fossil fuels. They use these large machinery of automobiles to establish their dominance, whether that's through emitting coal from their fume hoods, whether that's, you know, quote unquote, annoying the liberal by, you know, doing that. And she talks about that this is a form of climate refusal, but not climate denialism, meaning that this is actually feeding to the rhetoric of climate doom and climate negative scenarios that are happening, because she says that these people know that climate change is happening. There's no denying that. Fossil fuel industry is new since 1980s, like Exxon knew, like that report's already been out there. It's been unlinked, you know, they've known it. But she says that, you know, climate refusal is those people that are such congregated to this idea of American sovereignty, that fossil fuels are the only way to liberate themselves and to continue living the way of the American. And so she says that that's actually really closely tied to the outright and QAnon movements that are currently plaguing the countries, right? Especially in the United States, where it's very large power of white supremacy being perpetuated. And we saw this with our recent precedent that just happened with Trump, with the, you know, White House Capitol, with him saying that climate change wasn't real. And so she's saying that if we're not able to put a hold and put a check on these fossil fuel industries, they may essentially be going to be destroying the future countries in the global South, depleting their resources, getting them into war, destroying their livelihoods. And so petro-masculinity is a form of toxic masculinity as an additive that needs to be checked, because this is something where it is a money-making machine that is fueling the violence of predominantly women, trans women, femmes, non-binary folks who are most likely and are usually likely at the forefront of movements and then being harmed and killed under the name of American sovereignty and, you know, American politics.
Many people probably don't draw the link between, draw all of those links that you've just spoken about. And hearing you say those things will probably start to make people think, wow, what are we doing? And of course, petrochemical industry, fossil fuel industry, not the only industries where this is occurring. I'm sure you could list a whole bunch of others, am I right?
Yeah, no, definitely. Yeah. And that's obviously connected to everything else. And we see this too. And I mean, I'll make this very similar example with plastics and what happened in Texas with the border wall, where in Texas, Laredo, which is the predominantly Latin population, banned plastics from the city. The petrochemical industry hired lobbyists. They got so angry and they said, if you take away plastic bags from people, you're going to make them pay more money, and they're already poor, so that's already destroying their economy. Petrochemical industries already, and Texas itself was laughing at this issue, right? Like, the people were like, how dare they try to take away plastic from me? But it was already causing issues with the water, and then this fueled Trump to essentially say, we're going to build the border wall now there. And people were like, what? Like, for what reason? And so you realize that taking away plastic from these very rural and conservative states is also a form of petromasculinity, because they rely, and the city government does this, they're paid off by lobbyists, by the petrochemical industry. And so that threatens their economic well-being. And so that's another thing where I just recently learned about the border wall, like how a plastic bag and the border wall intersect.
These types of grassroots movements are growing ever increasingly. And one that stands out is the youth climate movement. What role do you see that movement having in the future of climate change and environmental issues?
Yeah, absolutely. I think the climate youth movement really represents a lot of dimensions of how, at a young age, so many young children are already traumatized in a world where there is housing, energy, medical, biodiversity, climate crisis. And you tell them, well, why are they so angry? And you're like, well, you know, and you know, as someone, I'm 26 myself. And so I also realized, like, I had a lot of privileges growing up as a teenager. Was I able to be a teenager in middle school? Yes, I was. But now you see these young 12, 13-year-old, 14-year-olds becoming more activists and being more publicly outspoken because their governments have failed them. The government, like you see, and this is where I become an educator, because the climate crisis and the educational crisis are the same thing. They cannot be separated. And this showcases the fact that young people are fed up with the governments, and, you know, some may want to overthrow it and some may want to, you know, redesign the policies, which I think is great too. And I think that's where climate youth movements come in, you know, with Greta and, you know, all the indigenous youth and Black youth activists that are changing the landscape, because this shifts the narrative to know that, you know, it sucks that we have to be, they have to be the adults. They're growing up to be the adults, essentially. And so they lose their childhood, but they're also advocating not just for them, but the younger people that are coming after them. And so I would say that climate youth movements really represent a lot of hope for me, but it's also the fact of the existing movements that have been out there that influence a lot of young people.
What's next on your agenda? What's on the radar for you in the next 12 months, 2 years? What's the future looking like?
Yeah, you know, I think for me, I realized how much I hated academia growing up when I was in college, and how it's bringing me back into the realm. So, you know, I think for myself, like, the idea wasn't to become an influencer online. I just built an audience and then, you know, it's there now. But I think for me, I really see myself finishing my book in the next 2 years, hopefully. I'll see how that goes. And also becoming more of a public speaker and educational consultant for institutions and schools. I really think that the work I'm doing isn't necessarily, Gen Z focused. I think of my work as more legacy work and the fact that I've been able to really develop my own framework and theories. Through, just writing about it. So I think that for me, it's just to continue being existent, healthy, and collaborative in this movement and really focusing more on my heart and what I want to get achieving to build the community and less on the idea of accolades and what's out there. And I really hope that's something that's true because I realize as a young person, the industry likes you more when you're young, but youth and young doesn't always exist. So I want to use it as a way to continue building more educational resources and help younger people and also work with older people that I've been learning from. And I realize having older adult friends is really cool because they really give a lot of depth to you. And I think your mid-20s is a very interesting time.
I dare say that your 16-year-old self probably doesn't agree with the statement of having a lot of older friends is really cool.
Yeah, I think I would definitely hate myself for that. And I mean, I think in academia, I barely had any older friends. I mean, like in sense of like there was like 2 years older than me, but I think when you graduate the bubble, you become immersed in different cultures. It's actually, I think the age for me to be friends with someone that's younger, I would say 21, 22, they start to develop themselves. I think that is something that is very true, but older generations have really provided me the foundation I need to continue my work and to push me to become more equitable.
What's the best way for people to keep track of what you're up to?
Yeah, you can follow me on any social at queerbrownvegan or email me at queerbrownvegan@gmail.com and very open to talking with anyone and just having a cool chat about life or climate or work and other things like that.
It's been really good having a chat with you today and hearing about all of the things that you're doing and the Queer Brown Vegan campaign and your environmental education and your environmentalism. So thank you so much for sharing and joining me.
No, I mean, thank you so much again for having me on this podcast. And it's been a really great honor to be able to speak with you.
The honor's mine. Honestly, it's been great to hear what you've been up to and so inspiring as well. So thank you. Thanks for listening to this episode of the Plasticology Project podcast. I hope you enjoyed this discussion and that it inspires you to get out there and do something for the world. If you've been enjoying the Plasticology Project podcast, please jump online and subscribe, leave a comment and a rating. That helps the audience grow and others to find about the Plasticology Project podcast. Also, don't forget to head over to the website www.docpjharvey.com. This has been another episode of the Plasticology Project podcast. Thanks for listening.